I also want to invite you to be comfortable and be here in a way during the talk that feels good to you. So not kind of coming here and trying to sit the way you think you're supposed to sit or whatever. You could lie down, lean against the wall, or sit in the chair. It's an important part of listening that you are listening from a place where you feel good. And that will in turn affect what I say. If you're listening from your goodness, then it makes it easier for me to speak from this goodness. And that builds a momentum, and that's what the talk is about. We could call the talk momentum. I'd like to start reading a poem by Carl Sandburg, who was an American poet. It's from a longer piece that he called Breathing Tokens. And my heart leapt when I found it again today after a few years. You were made for joy, child. The feet of you were carved for that. The ankles of you run for that. The rise of rain, the shift of the wind, the drop of a red star on a far water rim. An endless catalog of shouts, laughter, silent contemplations. They made you from day to day for joy, child. Sometimes we think that we're getting closer to each other when we can share our secrets. And usually what we mean is the painful secrets. And it is so important, as many of us know, to be able to speak what we've hidden, because it was so painful we thought it couldn't be said. But I'd like to add the possibility of sharing the other secrets. And I've noticed in talking to people, even if they have been meditating and devoting their lives to spiritual practice for decades, that when they really get to their most intimate secret of what they love, or an experience that they had of life that was mysterious, the hand goes over the mouth, literally. It's amazing. And they shy away from saying it. They say, oh, well, it sounds very cliche or whatever. Which is true. The words can't quite get it, but if we could trust ourselves that something can come across, even if the words aren't good enough, and that it may be important to get closer in this other way as well. Feeling free to share what we thought was negative, and when we say it out loud, we find out that a lot of other people had the same experience, and it's not a shame. It's not something to be ashamed of. And that allows the pain to be a different kind of pain. But why add this pain of hiding what we love most that's joyful? Or that's so mysterious that it took our breath away? If we could practice turning towards that catalog of shouts, laughter, silent contemplations that made us from day to day for joy. Child. And there are reasons in the poem and the way that it fits into the longer piece why the word child is used, but it's also important that the word child is used to remind us of what we've come to think of as adulthood, and to check into that, and to wonder about it, and maybe open it up a little bit. adults are more serious, more practical, don't laugh so much, don't play. The imagination plays with us, we don't play with our imagination. In one way, it's almost like adulthood equals anxiety in our cultural mode. So maybe we need to go back to child and grow up in a different way. And the funny thing is that this poem was actually shared with me by my father, my actual biological father. Which means that everything is possible. So I want to speak of momentum. Which is a word I like to use for the way interdependence works. So you may have heard the word interdependence. What it means is that we influence each other, that we're easily influenced by our environment, that we also influence our environment, that we're very sensitive, and that also a thought that I think now is likely to lead in a particular direction. It doesn't have to. A sound that I hear now might trigger a memory that leads in a certain direction, but it doesn't have to. Interdependence also means that we need each other, which we wouldn't like to, as adults, need each other. It's another thing we could shift in our understanding of adulthood. As an adult, there's a sense that each other is kind of the optional, an optional thing, instead of actually that we need each other. And that's not necessarily bad, it's not necessarily good, but it's inescapable. Interdependence also means that we're not as separate as we thought. And interdependence is not just this static fabric of being woven together inextricably, but there's a kind of, it would be like a fluid fabric, you could say. It's a very crude metaphor, but a fluid fabric where very easily a direction will happen, that I'm calling momentum. So if I think a thought about how I hate myself, the next thing that's going to happen is probably going to be influenced by that. Unless I catch myself and hear it and maybe laugh at it or try to talk to someone about it or think a different thought or something surprises me out of that negative momentum. And so we're very interested in finding out what interrupts that negative momentum. So you would remember a time that you were maybe having a difficult phone conversation, for example, that was really going downhill. You maybe weren't handling it very well, and maybe the other person wasn't either. And then something happened to interrupt the conversation, like the phone went dead, or you heard a sound, or you both said, wait a second, let's talk tomorrow, or whatever. Something interrupted, and it was a good thing. We want to be interested in interruption and learn how to interrupt when the momentum that's taking shape is destructive, when the momentum that's starting to happen is towards something that doesn't feel true to you, doesn't feel true to what's important to you. So sometimes in a conversation, you start to hear yourself sound like your mother or father, for example, or someone else. Or you're saying what you said, and you're saying it again, and you can't believe you're saying it again, but you can't quite get out of the role that's come upon you. It would be wonderful to learn how to interrupt that momentum. And the good thing about life is that it's not only that we have to figure out how to interrupt all these negative momentums and remember, you know, kind of be armed and prepared and shoot holes in the momentum. When we notice how negative momentum gets interrupted in our life by remembering, by noticing, it happens. And we can start to learn how to let it happen. When there's a destructive momentum, there's something about that momentum that isn't true to life. And so there will be ways that, maybe very subtle ways, that life pops up that disagree with that negative momentum, that thinking about how terrible I am or so-and-so is, or life or the planet, for example. And we can learn how to be a wider space with a little bit more ventilation so that life can pop through and help interrupt our habits. We also want to be able to get the feeling when what we could call a creative momentum is happening. Someone says a kind word and we feel a little softer or lighter, a smile happens. Then we notice the sound of that bird that we love or that we never noticed before. And it's a different world. In our own experience, we could actually notice that it is really almost like two different dimensions. Or maybe more than two, but the contrast is so great that at least two different dimensions. And what is the pull of that creative momentum? What does it feel like? And what is the pull of that destructive momentum, and what does it feel like? We can remember this capacity to feel, and we can refine, we can practice, and be able to feel it more easily, more quickly, more simply. We can believe what we're actually feeling. And allow that, I'm calling creative momentum. What I mean by creativity is that something unpredictable may happen. A fresh thought may come in. Not just a replacement thought that is basically tit for tat. I thought something bad about myself, let me think something good about myself. Sometimes that's better than nothing. But when I speak of creative momentum, which might get started by thinking the opposite thought to the negative, might get started that way. It might happen by the kind word and the bird. A thought that we haven't thought before might come. That's one example of creative momentum. And it's a good idea, better than what we would have come up with ourselves. And it feels spacious. And there starts to be something called patience that is not something we can really do on purpose, I find. When we try to do patience, we're really doing other things like frustration and resentment and tolerance and repression. But when we start to get this light-hearted feeling of the pull of creative momentum, and we start to let ourselves answer that positively, our cells also feel the kind of trueness of that openness, of that kindness. And they say yes. The cells say yes. And we usually get scared at that point. And it's okay. But if we could remember, we are made for joy, child. The second stanza of this part of the poem I want to read tonight. After having this reminder of all the ways that we're made for joy, that there's crying and contraction and pain, but there's also shouts and laughters and silent contemplations that also made us from day to day for joy. And then Carl Sandburg goes on and says, well, he sat up and said to himself, this is good. And this would be a good thing to do when the positive creative momentum is tugging at our ankles. It doesn't often get a chance to tug at our head. Our head is busy with negativity so often, or busy with being adult. When we feel that little tug of lightness at our feet, which were carved for joy, something in us sits up and says to itself, well, this is good. And it's a goodness that when we get to know it as trustworthy. It's not a kind of goodness that we get addicted to and then we're stuck. It's a different kind of goodness. There's a stream of Tibetan Buddhism that talks about basic goodness and where we can practice tuning into basic goodness in simple sense perceptions. Any simple sense perception. So whether we like what we see or not, we could be open to the basic goodness of the carpet, the colors, the texture. So we might or might not notice, like or dislike the sound of the fan. Often it happens that there would be a third of the people in the room who would really not like the sound of the fan, and a third of us who would really like it, and a third of us who haven't noticed that the fan was on or haven't heard the sound. That would be normal. We won't do the survey, but no matter what your response is, you're normal, put it that way. It's a normal response of the human mind to like, dislike, or ignore. But it's also possible to feel through that reaction to the sound and let it be sound. And they talk about drawing down the power in any sense perception, drawing down the power of connecting us to basic goodness. Not because I like it or dislike it or didn't notice it. And it's already changed. It's changing, changing, changing. And there's a kind of roundness they call basic goodness that we can meet. And it makes us experience ourselves as much bigger than we thought we are. And this is good. So, well, he sat up and said to himself, excuse the male, this is good. She also sat up and she also said to herself, this is good. I will go to it. So it's poetry. It's a little bit strange. But maybe we can get what he's talking about. Well, she sat up and said to herself, this is good. I will go to it. As we start to allow that contact with our true living, with our life, and it's good, even when we don't like it, even when we think it's ugly, that contact allows us to sense the basic goodness. I'm not talking about extreme things, but just like that tree that you think of as misshapen. And when you look at it again and let it be, it's like the line from the Tao Te Ching that I love. True perfection seems imperfect, yet is perfectly itself. And when we allow the shape of the tree to be as it is and have its basic goodness, something in us does sit up and is ready to go to it. And something in us is ready to go to it because something in us resonates with that freedom to be as we are and not to have to be according to the model. That misshapen is perfect. And when we connect really with that tree that we thought of as misshapen before, instead of our thought that it's misshapen, its beauty moves us. Till then, he had been satisfied with himself. Till then, she had been satisfied with herself. I like this line. Because even though most of us are not satisfied with ourselves, and that's one of our diseases in the industrialized culture, post-industrial culture, we're not really allowed to be satisfied with ourselves. It's a radical move to feel contentment. But there's a way that we're lazy in our busyness. In our addiction to busyness, we're lazy. We don't bother to get out of the busyness. We don't bother to slow down for 5 minutes in one day. We don't bother to go over to the book on the bookshelf that's calling to us and open it and read one line, which takes 10 seconds. We're swallowed into that momentum of the habit, that habit energy of busy, that habit energy that we call adult. And it's a deep perfectionism that we've come to believe in that keeps our motor running. So till then, we had been satisfied with ourselves. Where does that fit in? We're satisfied that we're doing our best because we're so tired. We're putting as much energy as we can into our lives. We're doing our best. We're caring with so much tension and anxiety. How could we care more? Till then, we've been satisfied with our efforts, with how we're trying, and in what kind of area of our experience we're focusing our efforts. Till then, we've been satisfied with ourselves, believing in perfectionism, that would be even something we would want. To be a copy of something of someone else, would we really want that? Do we really think that the people that are seen to be perfect look actually happy if you look through the magazines? And when we come more into the realm of meditation, I have a friend that I spoke to recently about his meditation practice. And he had been satisfied with his meditation practice because he has been sitting pretty much every day for an hour since he came on a retreat with me 12 years ago in India. And that is impressive. But then as soon as he spoke about his meditation practice, he was dissatisfied. He doesn't actually think he's meditating during that hour, and I think he's right. So it can be good to notice. Till then, we've been satisfied with ticking off 1 hour of meditation every day and being impressive. And when we decide that maybe we don't need to be so impressive is not so great. Impressive is a contagious disease as well. I try to be impressive, and then you feel you've got to be impressive. And then we're so busy impressing each other that we have no contact. So we start to be less satisfied with our impatience to be perfect. And until we're perfect, to try to be impressive. We start to be less satisfied with that as a mode of living. Till then, he'd been satisfied with himself. Now there came back an old unrest, carried over from a grandfather as was, the one grandfather he had failed to live up to. This is a curious little line that I could have left out, but we could think of grandfather, it could be really a grandfather, an actual biological ancestor, who was probably that weirdo who was living a genuine life. Or maybe the one who was really honest and could really see the grandson or the granddaughter. Or it could just be that one part of us that's somehow ancient and counts on life experience more than ideas that we've adopted. So now came back an old unrest. He had a hunch, a new hunch, another and another. Instead of ideas, whims, he had hunches. So he said, "This is good. I will go to it." We can start to drop down out of the thinking as we actually take into account our own experience. For example, in relationship, when we try to guide the relationship according to ideas, conflict is the result, eventually. Either we abide by the rule, the idea, for as long as we can hold it, and then something else happens. Something else explosively happens. We could also drop down even past the heart. So if you've noticed also, for example, in relationship, friendship, relationships at work, so not just intimate relationship, which not everyone is in one. We might sometimes use that coming to the heart as ammunition a little bit. But I feel hurt, or I feel angry. This might come across in words, or it might come across just in the tone and energy. So some people don't recognize the emotion, but the power of that emotional charge forces its way into the conversation and often gets its way. Or we might put it into words, because I feel hurt or because I feel angry, then there's no answer. You know, you kind of have to do what I say. It's the conditioned heart and the hurt heart speaking. And we need to leave room for the hurt heart and the conditioned heart, the heart that's been shaped by many forces and gets triggered and reacts. So a reactive heart. We need to leave room for that and tenderness for that, but not let that be where we live. Not let that be the only heart we go to. But dropping further down, sometimes actually coming into the lower belly or just the pelvic bowl, actually feeling that more often, dropping down from time to time during the day. We start to be in touch with where the hunches live. Do you have this word here? Okay. Not ideas, not whims, but hunches. And sometimes the hunch is an idea disguised as a hunch. But many times we can start to feel the difference between that movement of life that's an idea we've never had before, or it's an action we've never done before, like taking 5 minutes to slow down every day. For today. The hunches are what will lead us into a beautiful life. without changing our shape. We don't have to become unmisshapen. We can be misshapen of mind and heart and body, and find something else that's reliable to live by. That can give us a tremendous freedom of being, not being in a hurry towards perfection. Leaving room for things to happen, leaving room for the hunch to happen, leaving room for the movement to follow through on the hunch, and then another hunch, and another. So I have a friend who was speaking about his meditation practice, dissatisfied with it, as I told you. And then I made a couple of simple suggestions a little bit later, a couple of hours later, which he'd asked for. And he said, oh, but that's really hard for me. And then I said, well, I also really suggest you lie down for meditation. He's like, but isn't meditation a discipline? I said, yes, exactly. Exactly. You want to stick to your idea of discipline and not the actuality of discipline, where we let love pull us into the creative momentum, where we're willing to experiment with lying down because something in us realized we're actually dissatisfied with our 1 hour day that's so impressive. And we're kind of done with being impressive. But isn't discipline supposed to be hard? I promise you, by following your hunches, you will come up against challenges you never wanted to come up against, but something in you is so glad you did at the same time. So the discipline of noticing what we're avoiding and postponing as we busily try to be perfect, whether on the surface or whether inside, we try to be perfect. As we start to feel the goodness of how things are happening by themselves in the body and with the sounds, for example, for a little while, the goodness of leaving that space where things are happening by themselves. We start to be more friendly with chaos and confusion, and less friendly with our choices. So the situations where we feel that we have the power to make a choice, and that seems to feel good in a certain way. And a little bit questioning. Partly by looking at the situations that happened to you, where you had no choice. And how was that? A small example from a remote place to bring it maybe home a little bit. In India, there was quite a healthy diet, and there was much also less poverty as there is now. And then there was the British rule for centuries, and the British diet now is considered to be healthy to have white bread with jam that has no fruit in it. That's offered as a breakfast that would give you power by a lot of Indians, because that's how they've received it from the powerful British. But the people who were out of power didn't have access to the processed grains and kept growing, for example, the millets that they traditionally grew or the red rice that they traditionally grew. And that's how we still have those grains today, is through what seemed like a lack of choice, which was also a lack of choice. But it was a really good idea not to wipe out those indigenous grains. The people in our family that we don't have a choice, they're in our family. We want them to be different usually, even if we like them. There are things that we don't like. And we have no choice to say, actually, I'm going to get a different model of father or mother or whatever. Son, daughter, sister, brother, etc. The situations that we notice, it doesn't work when we stay with our ideas, and it doesn't work when we just get knocked around by our pain getting triggered. But there might be a way that something does keep happening, keep coming up, that kind of works and has extreme patience because it's not counting the clock. Because it's leaving space and not thinking that I've got to do it and I've got to be the perfect son, daughter, mother, father, sister, brother, etc. Are there any questions before we end?
Yes, please. Are you thinking about intuition?
No. Intuition is part of the story. And when we have a sense of having an intuition and wanting to go by the intuition, it's a really good start. And if we can keep thinking of it as a good start and keep letting it deepen and evolve or get its full depth, so that we could even go beyond the poem where a hunch comes and then he said, this is good and I will go to it. And it comes more and more immediately without even the processing of what's my intuition, yes, no, yes, okay, yes. Yeah. Less and less processing, but processing when there needs to be processing. The fact of being able to pause, to be unsatisfied with my habitual response, to pause, to check, to feel the pull towards the creative momentum and to let that take you is a great training, great practice. But sometimes some people use the word intuition as the final kind of product or something. If we could let it be a practice that brings us to more depth, more and more depth. More and more trust in staying with openness even when there's something we don't like. Trusting life that there will be a way to work with the situation, so to speak, or to play with it. Which sometimes with intuition, as soon as there's the reaction, maybe fear, we lose track of, we can't find the intuition. So we make a best guess anyway.
How does that work in relation to, say, routine, say, things that are working well for you?
Yeah.
And if something's working well for you and you have a hunch to do something opposite to that, it's almost crazy thing to do.
Yeah. So sometimes it is the crazy thing to do. It's the old habit energy tugging, the negative, destructive momentum pulling. And other times it's, even though intuition is great, there's something in us that is expansive and loves adventure, not for the adrenaline rush, but for the freedom that comes from being allowed to have a good routine and to let that be like a stepping stone towards the next practice, the next step into our mystery and our depth. So it's hard sometimes to tell the difference between the destructive and the creative momentum, the fresh and the old. And it's good practice to test it out. But it's a great question. Sometimes we need to leave behind what's working. And sometimes it's self-sabotage that's happening. sometimes that good routine is the momentum that does guide somewhere else. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We have some time for tea. And also thank you for any donations you feel like putting in the box that can help support my family while I do what I love to do. It's what my family is floating along on. So thank you very much.